guys know about fireballs? That's if you start to fall asleep.
Oh.
They're hot.
Thanks.
Is this other one?
I'm going to check it out. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16.
I made an announcement this morning that we were audio taping. We also wanted to videotape this lecture. Does anyone have a problem with being recorded on videotape?
Yes.
I don't. Are you guys going to videotape? Make it easy for you guys.
Anyone else? Okay. Thank you.
Did anybody not get an Italian fireball? Oh, we better
are we all set?
Thank you.
And this is the Atlas of Breeding Birds of Michigan. And it's a tremendous resource. And I'm going to put it up in the bird lab because it'll be important for you to look at when you're putting together the project paper. And I'm just going to show you, for example, the Merlin. This side of the page has basically a summary on biology, ecology, and so on. And this is a map using breeding bird survey data showing what's known about the distribution of Merlins in the state. So you can see from the blue dots that, you know, there's not a lot concentrated up here on Iowa. And if I just flip to, give me another species. Oh, here, I'll do it. I just found it. Here's the cowbird, for example. So anyway, it's very nice because each species is has a record in here. And you have to remember from what I said this morning, there are some species where the data are a lot better than others. So some of these are probably a lot more accurate than for the more secretive species. But
how old is that book, Francie?
About 91, I believe, or 90 or 91. 1991. Okay, this afternoon, my plans are to talk to you about avian conservation and management in the United States. There's obviously a much broader picture that we could be looking at, but I want to focus in the United States for a number of reasons. And I've done a couple things on the blackboard. This is... Well, I put together some stages of conservation and management in the U.S., and I'm going to kind of go through these and talk about why these are important to birds. And over here is a list of some important pieces of legislation as they relate to birds as individual species or populations. And the first thing that I want to do is kind of go through and talk about these general stages, and then I'm going to show you some slides with some selected examples. The period of time pre-1850 is thought of not only for birds, but for all essentially wildlife species as a period of abundance. And of course, this includes the time that North America was occupied by Native Americans on up to basically when European settlement began to occur. And then on until the period of 1850. And during this time period, when the European settlers first came and the early explorers, they found, of course, this unbelievable abundance. And this was a real shock because the populations had been very overhunted throughout Europe. And for these people to arrive and find this abundant game that could be used for food was part of the mystique and the wealth of our country. Well, in the period of time between about 1850 and the 1900s, this was a time period where this abundance really began to decline. There were lots of examples prior to that time of local losses and abundance, but the year 1850 to about 1900 really marks a time period of significant declines, and the species that you identified with during that time period, the number one species people typically would identify would be the bison, and the fact that bison almost disappeared. And as far as a bird species, the primary bird species that is identified at that time period is a passenger pigeon. And I'm going to say more about this later on. I just want to kind of do an overview so when I do the slides, you can kind of relate to it in your mind. In response to this over-harvesting, which occurred for many species, it was not simply the passenger pigeon and the bison, people began to recognize that some type of legislation was needed to curb the over-harvesting. And there were several things that happened. And the time period of 1900 to 1930 is thought of as a time period where several very key pieces of legislation were passed at the federal level. And two of these I have up on the board. One's called the Lacey Act, and the other is called the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, Lacey, L-A-C-E-Y. And basically, one of the reasons that the over-hunting and over-harvesting had such a big impact on wildlife species was because of something called market hunting. And that was that means that a relatively few number of individuals became organized and had a good communications network and would harvest huge numbers of a particular species. In the case of the pasture pigeons, is a very good one. And these would be killed and then shipped in some relatively rapid and safe way, often salted, off to large markets. At this time, it was prior to, you know, having poultry farms and having big meat markets and so on. So these were in high demand as a source of fresh meat. And the Lacey Act was passed, and it made it illegal to ship between state lines or across state lines. Now, this may seem like a fairly small and minor piece of legislation, but this was aimed at the market hunters who could be harvesting pasture pigeons in Wisconsin, for example, and wanting to take them to big markets in Chicago. So this was considered a really very vital piece of legislation. It was in about 1920 that a real landmark piece of legislation was passed, and it's referred to as the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. And it has had several modifications, and the basic act makes it illegal to possess, kill, disturb any migratory bird. Now, this actually has been extended to include non-migratory species, so it basically comes down to protecting native species, at first in the United States, but we now have agreements with Canada, for example, and Mexico, so it's a very extensive agreement regarding protection of migratory species and native species. And this came into play because of concern about overharvest, particularly in waterfowl. Many of the ducks breed in Canada and may winter in the Gulf or down considerably further south. So they were passing through different bureaucratic zones, and in some areas they were protected, in some they were not. And there was tremendous concern about the harvest, heavy harvest occurring in Canada before waterfowl even got to the U.S. So this is what spurred on this agreement to begin with, and then it's been extended essentially to all species. Any exotic species is not protected. The house sparrow is not protected. The mute swan is not protected. The European starling is not protected. And it is possible to get depredation permits for some species that are protected. For example, if you have woodpeckers damaging your home, you can get permission to have them removed. Or if you have red-winged blackbirds damaging your rice crop, you can get permission to have those removed. If you're an airport, Helston Airport gets depredation permits so that they can kill gulls, for example, that sit on the runway. So there are some examples of how to avoid this this particular piece of legislation under certain circumstances. But this piece of legislation is very far-reaching. It's not just killing. It is any possession of. So it's illegal to hold any wild bird in captivity. A pet store was probably went out of business in Sheboygan. They had that goldfinch in a cage there. And some of the plover people were in there getting mealworms for the plovers and saw the goldfinch and reported it to the local conservation officer, and the pet store is not there anymore. So we don't We don't know exactly what happened, but we speculate that that could be related. There are all kinds of reports of native species showing up at pet stores in the Chicago area. One primary species is a cardinal, interestingly. I think things are tightly controlled now, and I think that's fairly rare. It's also, as I said, illegal to possess birds' eggs or nests without appropriate permits. And it is illegal to possess dead birds. So if you're driving along and you find a ray-horned owl that's dead, and you think, oh, I can do something nice with this for my bedroom. if a conservation officer were to find out about it, you would be violating a federal law. Typically, they are only going to get involved and pay attention to high-profile species like eagles, for example. But there are lots of cases of people being turned in for much lesser crime, so to speak. Technically, it's illegal to possess feathers. Again, the primary feathers, of course, that are being focused on are eagle feathers. Historically, there's some others like egret plumes and so on. So if you walk around with a gold feather in your hat, you probably are not going to get arrested, but it is against federal law. So I point this out because this piece of legislation was passed, and I think it's had a very major effect on bird conservation. Prior to that time, birds were harvested very casually. People, there has always been kind of a negative reaction towards birds of prey, and people felt like they were damaging their farms and maybe killing chickens, whatever, and people just randomly would shoot birds of prey. A wide variety of birds have been harvested for food, even those that we don't think of as native species. And actually, in other parts of the world, people in some areas, they feed very heavily or eat a lot of small songbirds. I believe that France has just passed some legislation that now makes it legal to shoot and eat songbirds again. For a while, it was illegal. I think that that'll end up being changed just because of public pressure, but we tend to think of just a few certain species as being consumed, but historically there's been a wide range of birds that have been eaten. I think there are just a lot of factors that have sprung from, or effects that have sprung from the Migratory Bird Treaty Act that have had a very positive benefit on bird protection. And I think there are a lot of things that we can't even measure, but it is a very important piece of legislation. The next period of general stage of conservation in the U.S. is a time period of management and ecology from about 1930 to 1970. And it was this time, during this time period, that wildlife management programs were being developed around the country. And the first one was founded by Aldo Leopold. Many of you recognize his name at the University of Wisconsin. He wrote a text on wildlife management. And the focus at this time was really primarily on species that could be harvested for human consumption and how to manage these numbers so that they could be harvested at a high level and still remain as a stable population. And so what this meant was wherever management was going on regionally, there would be a handful of species that would be getting the attention, would be getting funding from typically the State Department of Natural Resources and federal funding. So here in the state of Michigan, it would have been species like ruffed grouse, woodcock, the waterfowl, for example, all of these deemed as important economic species that people were interested in harvesting. At the same time, hand in hand with good management and knowing how to sustain these populations over a long time period was an understanding of their biology and ecology. So a lot of studies in wildlife ecology were going on at the same time. Well, it was, these time periods are kind of general, but it was around the 1970s that people became very concerned about environmental quality issues. And the first Earth Day was established. And at this time, people began to think a lot wider than just at the species level or just focusing on species as having value for humans. And there was a major shift in people stopping and saying, you know, here we have all this time and energy that's going into managing a handful of species, and we know there are other species that need attention as well. One group being endangered species. The precursor to the Endangered Species Act was a Bald Eagle Act, which recognized the fact that bald eagles had declined in number. And this act was passed authorizing full protection and funding to attempt to recover the eagle population in North America. And this was later converted into a broader perspective, an Endangered Species Act. So the management efforts continued basically at a single species or population level, still focusing on heavily on game species, but beginning to include a broader group, endangered species, and some kind of special interest species. One example, I'll say something later about, is the bluebird. Bluebird numbers have declined, and people got together, Boy Scout troops, garden clubs, and so on, began putting up bluebird houses. So here was an example of a species being protected, not because it was exceedingly rare and not because it could be harvested, but because people like bluebirds. They were concerned about their declining numbers. The environmental awareness time period continues up until to today, but superimposed on that came a recognition starting in about the late 1980s and really kind of peaking in about 1990. It began with people's concern about the loss of biodiversity in the rainforests, and people began to see this was happening on a global scale and see that rainforests were just one of many ecosystems that were experiencing loss of biodiversity. So all of a sudden, a shift began to occur, and this is when graduate programs began to spring up in universities that are referred to as conservation biology programs. And these programs are similar to wildlife management, but instead of really targeting species and selected species, conservation biology programs focus on basically protection and management of all living things or all biodiversity. And of course, this meant all birds then fell within the realm of biodiversity. And at this time, there were some other events that were occurring that were important. And one was the focus on fact that here in North America, people were recording what they perceived as being important declines in forest birds. So all of this led people to start realizing that so much time and energy had focused on such a few number of species, maybe we should be thinking about population trends in common species, or certainly not in rare species, but representative species of a particular region. In this time period of environmental awareness and the more recent one of global biodiversity protection, there are a couple of other pieces, important pieces of legislation. One is called CITES, that's the acronym, and that stands for Convention in International Trade in Endangered Species. Convention for for international trade in endangered species. And this is not a piece of legislation. It is a treaty. It's an agreement among many nations of the world to respect a list, basically, of endangered and threatened species that has been prepared. It's a global list prepared by a conservation group, the International Union for Conservation of Nature. You don't have to remember that. I would like you to know CITES. Many nations have signed this agreement, and what it means is that they will not import or export species on the list. And it's some countries are very rigid in enforcing this and in checking for it. The United States, for example. However, you know, we have millions of people that are entering and exiting our country every week. And there's no way that even good enforcement is going on. But there are people, you know, the enforcement is in place and they have basically a sampling effort. There are some countries that, you know, have signed and they ignore the agreement. And periodically, we, the United States, places trade sanctions on them when something is exposed to try and get them to link in better with the agreement. This is important for birds. The number one group of birds that it probably affects the most. Does anyone know what that might be? Pet trade birds?
Parrots.
Parrots. Most of the parrots of the world have a threatened or endangered status, and it is primarily from the pet trade. And the CITES is one of the strongest, as I said, not a piece of legislation, but strongest agreement that helps to curb trade in parrots. Another important piece of legislation is called the Fish and Wildlife Management Act. And this was passed in the 1980s. And this is a very strange piece of legislation. Passed at the federal level. And what it said was, it said, for any state that has a non-game program established, we will provide money. So, and this piece of legislation was passed. So the states, a good chunk of them, about 60%, said, hey, this is a potential for tremendous extra revenue for our wildlife programs. So we're going to gear up and we're going to get a non-game program. And the non-game was not just for birds, it was mammals, typically fish, amphibians and reptiles, and in many cases plants as well. So all these states jumped up and got these programs going. Michigan did, Minnesota did, as an example. Basically all except some of the poorer states got these programs going. And then Congress never came through with money. Well, they had to do things to get these programs going. They had to kind of find money in between. And many of them did it through things like income tax checkoffs. We have one in Minnesota, and I believe there's one in Michigan as well, where you choose to donate $10 or whatever on your income tax. There are states that sell special license plates, and the money goes into it. Some through lottery, all kinds of things. But these programs got established, and they were very, very significant because they got individual states to start thinking about species other than the ones that they had traditionally supported for so many years through hunting and fishing licenses and just general appropriations from the legislature. Yeah.
What is a non-game program?
A non-game program means in a typical Department of Natural Resources, they would have like a division of fishes, and their money and their energy would be going into making sure there are enough perch to keep the population of Michigan, the fishing population, happy, enough walleye, enough trout in the streams, enough, you know, so all game related. they had no concern about things like sturgeon that were declining. No money would go there. Even though sturgeon is a game fish, they're just not common enough to worry about, and they never would be. So they would kind of fall by the wayside. A lot of the, there's some tremendously interesting minnows and other non-game, non-hunted, essentially, species that would not get any attention. In the wildlife section, you would have somebody who deals with upland game, the grouse, the woodcock, the snipe. Then you'd have a specialist who dealt with the waterfowl, for example. And then you would have somebody who was the forest ungulates, the moose and the deer, and or large game, include bear, and somebody who also, or several people who were dealing with the trapping the small mammal species. Those are all the game, hunted for game or harvested for a product for humans. Non-game is anything that's not hunted. So most of the bird species, for example. Until the 1980s, states did not even think about it. They put no money towards chickadees or owls or, you know, whatever. It was just believed that the energy that went into protecting the game species would spill off and protect the non-game. So if you set aside a wildlife refuge for waterfowl, then think of all the good it would do for marsh wrens and bitterns and so on. And the same for forested areas. So the 1980s was a real key point of getting the public and getting legislators to, you know, change the way money was appropriated. Okay, so now we're at a time where people are recognizing that we don't have the time, we don't have the money to focus species by species or population by population. So the energy has to be spread more widely. And many bird conservation efforts are focused at the community or ecosystem level. That's what I've been trying to do with piping plover work, is to think about the other species of plants that are involved. Think of the entire dune complex. Use the plover as a species with federal status that can help in protection, but don't do it at the expense of other species, which is what has happened in the past. Now, here we are now dangling at this, or headed in this direction of concern for global or regional biodiversity protection. And the question is, you know, what's the next step in the future? Well, I don't know exactly where it is, but I see one issue that's coming up in terms of conservation and management that people are having tremendous problems dealing with, and that is we've been very successful with a lot of species, and human activities are changing ecosystems, and we're having global pattern changes. And we now have overabundant wildlife. And some of these are tolerable at certain levels. Some are not tolerable in a lot of different spots. And some are causing very significant ecosystem problems in big regions of North America. I'm going to give you the details on this in just a few. So I see that as an area that is going to be very challenging because it involves ethics. It involves, you know, where do we step in and say, these numbers are too much for us to bear as humans, how should we make these decisions, whether to try and control populations, and how should this be done? Should it be done? Should we do this for every species that we see as a nuisance? Or are we naturally going to see these fluctuations anyway, and do we need to step back and just let them occur, knowing that there will be some times when people feel uncomfortable with the density of a particular species? And this is, you know, something that's occurring with plants, insects, you know, mammals. It also has occurred with birds. Okay, I think that I've covered everything I wanted to about legislation and these general stages. So what I want to do now is go through some slides and talk about the species and how they fit into these different conservation stages. But I'm going to have to answer some questions. The 1966 is the year that is typically given. I can't tell you, I don't know when the Bald Eagle Act was initially passed. And what happens is that the Endangered Species Act is periodically up for reauthorization. And a few years ago, it was very close. There was a lot of heavy pressure, and people were really looking at the Endangered Species Act. And then that was the time when the federal government was shut down for whatever it ended up being, a week or so. And that just kind of brought that reauthorization process to an end. The concerns about the Endangered Species Act, it's considered the most powerful piece of environmental legislation that has ever been passed. There are a lot of concerns by biologists and by non-biologists. There are concerns that it infringes on citizen rights when endangered species occur on private land. That's a very big issue that is leading a lot of legislators to push to have modifications or changes made there. From a biologist's perspective, there are many cases where the Endangered Species Act has been used to promote the survival of a single species at the cost of other species within the ecosystem, and people feel uncomfortable with that. One of the things that people may feel most uncomfortable about, those who work with endangered species, is the allocation of money. There are about 10 species that end up getting, you know, about $50 million a year from Congress. And these species are not logically ones that you would feel should be receiving the money. Some of them are, but some are marginal in terms of they are rare anyway in North America. There's been some efforts that have gone into ocelots and some of the species that are found in Central America and occur just over the border in southwestern U.S. and received a lot of money. The California condor has received tremendous amounts of money. And, you know, maybe for justifiable reasons. A huge amount of money went into the bald eagle. The Kirtland's warbler here in the state of Michigan has received millions of dollars. And then there are other species like the piping plover that we typically get about $10,000 a year, which barely pays for anything. So people feel there should be more of a reallocation of funds, and that these, you know, really big money species need to be evaluated and reevaluated as to whether that's justified. And a lot of the decisions seem to be very political as to which critter gets the money. Maybe the money that's gone into the spotted owl issue. You know, maybe some of these, you know, I could argue on either side, but that's been a big issue. Okay. Have you guys eaten fireballs? You better, because I'm going to turn this light down. And just burst in if you have questions. Let me see. I'm going to figure something out. Oh, there. Whoop. Let me see what it's going to be like here. Abundance and followed with over harvest. And this might be a surprise to you, but one of the groups that was very heavily harvested were the shorebirds. They would come through areas during migration in the hundreds of thousands and millions of birds. They congregate along shorelines, and they were shot for food. And in fact, they're very good eating. And many species, and the piping plover is one that there are records of them being harvested. I don't know what kind of an impact there may have been on plovers.
Have you ever eaten a plover?
Oh, no.
Have you ever eaten a shorebird at all?
No, I've never eaten a shorebird. I've eaten, tasted the herring gulls and Caspian terns, birds that had died from injuries. And they were not particularly good. Very stringy. Another group that was very heavily harvested were, of course, the waterfowl. That's, you know, that's not a surprise. And some numbers were really, really low, and some populations were almost eliminated as breeding populations in some of the states. And it was the waterfowl declines that really were a big stimulus for the passing of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. And we today have just a tiny fraction of what we once had in the way of waterfowl species. Now, excuse me, not species, but waterfowl population numbers. Now, one of the things that has happened, of course, is that we no longer have the problem of over-harvest in North America. That has been replaced by the problem of habitat loss. So historically, over-harvesting was the number one problem, and today it's habitat loss and its various various categories, from degradation and change, possibly through contaminants, to fragmentation of habitat, to just direct harvesting of forests or conversion of native prairie into ag land. Now this is one that I'm going to tell you a story about. This is what species?
Ringbill gull.
And this has a neat story that you don't hear about elsewhere. It's really not written up anywhere, but it is in old literature, so you can find it. The ringbill gull was present during, you know, the settlement time, the pre-settlement. And in what numbers, we really don't know, but it was present in the Great Lakes. By the early 1900s, it had disappeared as a breeding species in the Great Lakes, which is hard to imagine. In the state of Michigan right now, based on the survey we did this summer, there are about 100,000 pairs nesting in the state of Michigan. So what would happen to cause the ringbills to disappear as a breeding species in the Great Lakes? They nest in good-sized colonies, and they have an egg that's ranked as being high in terms of its taste, palatability. There's actually a scale of egg palatability that somebody worked out quite some time ago. And when harvesting of eggs for food was a legal thing to do. So market hunters knew about these egg supplies, and they would start at the south end of Lake Michigan, at the south end of Lake Huron, so Detroit region, Chicago region. They would move north. The colonies really don't start until about Saginaw for Lake Huron, and then they go all the way up to northern Lake Huron, where we had breakfast at Search Bay, the area where we did the black tern census. And then the ringbill colonies start about a line about Traverse City, the islands off the offshore, the Manitous, and so on. And so these boats would stop at all the ringbill colonies on their way north, and they would smash all of the eggs. They'd go north as far as they could, they'd turn back, and then they'd stop at all the islands, and wherever they found eggs, those they would collect, because they knew they were fresh. They were early in incubation, so they were not going to have large embryos. And then they would pack these in the barrels of salt, and and take them down to Chicago and Detroit to be sold in the markets. Now, at the same time, it was a tremendous fashion for women to wear feathers in hats and other clothing here and also in Europe. And birds with white feathers were particularly sought after because these feathers could be dyed. So adults were also harvested. So this type of market hunting and very intense pressure went on with the ringbill gulls, and because they nest in large colonies, they were much more vulnerable than herring gulls that tend to have less dense colonies. So the ringbill was knocked back, and it was through protection efforts that made it illegal to sell these feathers and illegal to sell the eggs in these large markets that brought the ringbill gull back. And by 1924, the first ringbills were reported nesting in the northern Great Lakes. It was either Huron, I think it was in northern Lake Huron. And then they've slowly increased to the point where in many areas they're now perceived as a problem because they've done so well in association with humans. But this was a species that was harvested to extinction within a region. Okay, here's another species that was heavily harvested. This is Sandhill crane. And this is still a hunted species. In many areas, the numbers were brought very, very low. They are hunted in some of the western states, but this was another one that was over-harvested. Now, this is what?
Morning
dove. You didn't know they were so gaudy, did you? Blue eye ring and all those details. Well, the morning dove is not the one I'm going to talk about. It's actually the passenger pigeon that I think is the most interesting of the over-harvested species. And the passenger pigeon is believed to have been the most abundant land bird ever on the face of the earth, historically and up to modern times. They existed in the billions, and they were a bird of the eastern deciduous forest. They were a massed crop feeder, feeding on beech nuts, was a prime food source for them, and also on acorns, but primarily beech. And they would, they're also colonial nesters and roosters, and wherever they occurred in the hundreds of thousands. And there were historical nest sites and roost sites that, you know, people reported you couldn't help missing. I mean, if you've got several hundred thousand birds in your property, you know that. And they, of course, doves are hunted in many states. And the pasture pigeon, as an adult bird, the meat was highly sought after. No one was interested in the eggs, but the young were also eaten, squabs. And it was the same thing as with the gulls. There were a handful of people, you know, we're talking about dozens and dozens of people throughout the eastern deciduous forest, but in comparison to the whole human population in eastern North America, it was small, who became organized to hunt the pasture pigeon and bring these into the large markets, so large markets throughout the eastern U.S. And there were a number of things that went on that helped this this whole process. One was the railroad came in, and there were railroad lines throughout eastern U.S. so they could quickly put birds onto the train and send them into markets immediately. Another was the invention of the telegraph. They could communicate. Somebody could send a message and say, I've just found a colony of, you know, here in southern Wisconsin at such and such a place, and they'd get 20 men on the train and whip over there and harvest them. So the communication network and the transportation network was really critical in terms of the demise, so to speak, of pasture pigeons. Well, another thing about pasture pigeons that played an important role is that they're highly social, and it's thought that they will not nest solitarily and do not really could not be successful unless there were large numbers of them. And it's not sure exactly what those reasons are. But the market hunting, of course, could not individually kill billions of birds. But they went in year after year for 10 or more years and constantly disturbed these colonies until the birds were deserting, the young were dying, birds were being killed, birds were not breeding. So the pasture pigeon did not breed for 10 to 15 years. And literally, in that short time period, became extinct. The last bird died in captivity in the Cincinnati Zoo in the early 1900s. So this example has been such a powerful one. How could you ever imagine that something that existed in the billions, a vertebrate no less, could be driven to extinction in such a short time period? Well, it did happen, and it's, you know, it really is a symbol of not the conservation movement, but the over-harvest and the impact, potential impact that humans can have on a species or on populations. So it's a very, very powerful story and figured in an important way in subsequent conservation efforts. Okay, the next group, so that's really the period of abundance and over-harvest. And the next group, the next issue I want to talk about is the era of wildlife management and studies on ecology. And here's a species of Canada goose that you're well familiar with. You've heard me say a few things about it. This was an over-harvested species. In the state of Minnesota, they were extirpated. They were eliminated as a breeding species in the 1920s in the state. That's a long time ago. And the people in charge of waterfowl, the Department of Natural Resources folks, said, this is a tremendous resource. People want this. They want to be able to harvest Canada geese. We will bring them back. So they did this through reintroduction, by bringing in birds from other states where the populations were more robust. Well, what's happened in Minnesota is that we now have a huge population of Canada geese, and they are valued as a hunted species. So there is a hunting season. But they also are viewed as a non-game species. People have, many urban areas have brought Canada geese into their parks. And at first this was wonderful because there'd be a couple of families and everybody liked to go and see the babies in the spring. And then all of a sudden the numbers began to increase. And the birds get up on the golf greens and eat the grass, which is not appreciated, and defecate, which is not appreciated, and they defecated tremendous amounts on sidewalks where runners are jogging around the lakes in the Twin Cities. There's always a crisis about too many geese. But at the same time, when they tried to do something about it, there were people who wanted them there, even in large numbers. So it's led to a lot of court cases and interactions between animal rights groups, between management people, between the airport that is concerned about human safety because geese have caused some fatal accidents. And we're left with a species that is an overabundant species in many areas. In Minnesota, they shipped extra birds to every place they could. And finally, all those places said, we can't take any more Canada geese. And one of the things that they did try next, and were successful for a while, was doing a planned harvest, and all the geese went to local food shelves. And that was very popular, but there were also legal concerns, and now pressure from some of the animal rights groups has stopped that. And they found somewhere, I think it's Oklahoma, that they've been sending extra geese to. So this is an issue. We have someone in my department back in Minnesota who has contracts with all the local communities, or many of the local communities, like $5,000 to $20,000 contracts for goose management there's a single species effort to manage a species for harvest that has been too successful, you might say. Ruffed grouse is another species that's been managed. I've mentioned this one before because the recipe for good ruffed grouse production is very opposed to what is needed to for good conservation of forest birds. Grouse need a mix of forest ages, so it's recommended that the forest be viewed as a 24-year harvest cycle. You break it into four sections and you rotate through. So every 24th year, the oldest aspen are allowed to grow until they're 24 years, and then they're harvested. But you always have, every sixth year, you have some harvest that's going on. So this means you have a fragmented forest, you have a very young forest, and species of birds that do not do well in this in the fragmentation are really being managed to their detriment, so to speak. So this was a case of single species management. It's been popular. This is a number one game species, upland game species, bird species in Minnesota that more hunters get permits for this than others. Now, here's a species, like the Canada goose, was extirpated from a lot of regions of eastern North America, the wild turkey. And in some cases, in Minnesota, it's doubtful that they ever were there, but they were close by. And so departments of wildlife have introduced turkeys. That's what was the situation here in Michigan. Turkeys were native to Michigan, and now, it must have been about 20 years ago, they undertook a big reintroduction program. And that's why you're seeing them around the station area. These are birds that probably came from Missouri. That seems to have been one of the most successful stocks for the more northern states. So they're wild birds found native in North America, but these are not genetically Michigan birds. Well, this reintroduction goes to its extreme with a number of species, and the ringneck pheasant is a perfect example. This is a species that's highly desirable. Hundreds of thousands of dollars go into this species in the Midwestern states, up to the millions of dollars in some cases, to manage for the ringneck pheasant. This bird is found in Asia. It's not a native species. And it does well in many agricultural regions as long as there's good cover and not harsh winters. This was okay in the 1930s to the 1970s, but a lot of people question the value of and the ethics of bringing in non-native species. For a long time, people thought that pheasants had no negative impact on the land. They now know that pheasants will lay their eggs in prairie chicken nests, for example, and the pheasant eggs hatch sooner. When they hatch and the chicks leave the nest, prairie chicken parents desert their eggs and go with the pheasant babies. So that is a negative, and it may have affected prairie chicken populations. The states will probably, within my lifetime, will never touch the pheasant. It means too much financially. It's a highly desired harvested species, and the negative impacts are too minor. Okay. Another group of managed species are the endangered species. It's kind of special interest ones. And the peregrine falcon was one, like the bald eagle, that was affected by problems with DDT, so that it had eggshell thinning. And tremendous money and energy has gone into essentially reestablishing peregrine falcons in the U.S. They were essentially gone. And it's been through a very intensive program of captive rearing and releasing birds into locations where they were historically around North America that has reestablished them. They're not large numbers, but released birds. And they're, they've done extremely well in urban areas, so that's been very popular. They use skyscrapers like cliffs, and they feed on pigeons and other house sparrows and so on, and they do very well. This bald eagle puppet is being used to hand rear a young eaglet. A lot of energy, of course, went into bald eagles. In some areas, they did reintroductions of young birds. In many areas, it only took good protection, like in the state of Michigan, the national ban of DDT, along with good protection around the nest sites and so on, has led to a recovery that will probably take the bald eagle off the endangered species list in a relatively short period of time. This is a female Kirtland's warbler, and this is another species that received a tremendous amount of, and still continues to get, a tremendous amount of financial support, and they require a very specific habitat of jack pines of a certain age, and they nest only in jack pines. And it was found that they had very heavy parasitism by brown-headed cowbirds. And so a major program to remove the cowbirds was instituted. Now, this is objectionable to some people from an ethics perspective because you are placing a higher value on the life of a Kirtland's warbler than on a brown-headed cowbird. And, of course, that's debatable in lots of different ways. But the program still, it continues on. And the Kirtlands, after many years, are finally, they went from about 200 pairs up to over 800. Nancy?
Why was there so much emphasis put on this bird? Just to,
well,
to
the Kirtland's warbler, I used to take classes there on a trip, but it it's something that you can do on your own. They are found in the Gaylord Grayling area, and they are found only, they breed only in central Lower Peninsula of Michigan, nowhere else in the world. And that's what makes them a really special species. They're endemic to that region of Michigan, found nowhere else. They winter in the Bahamas. And unlike, say, the piping plover, where their populations, Atlantic coast, northern Great Plains, here in the Great Lakes, even though there are fewer plovers, this bird is a high priority because of its uniqueness. And that's why it received all the attention. Also, because it was on Forest Service land and the forest and this link with jack pines, Forest Service could get involved with money. Fish and Wildlife Service had money. So together, they could make a united force towards management of the species that you don't see with some of the other species just because the money's not there. Julie?
What's its call?
It says, cheer, 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 Larry.
Cheer, 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 Larry.
Cheer, 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 Larry. And it's a very, very distinctive. If you, they have tours. You have to go on a tour into the breeding area in the spring. I think they start late April, maybe. The best time is any time in May, and you're essentially guaranteed of hearing and or seeing the Kirtlands. They're not at all shy. They'll just pop right out and start singing, and they're easy to see. Yeah, Alan.
It's kind of off the subject. What about the bat that you wrote? The bird book said that they might be extinct. It's kind of old bird if there's.
I can't tell you. I mean, that's all I know, that there's, you know, there's this debate about whether or not they're still. There are other species that, where people just don't know the status. So I'm sorry, I can't answer that. I mentioned before that the bluebird was not endangered in terms of small numbers and certainly not a harvestable species, but it was something, a species that people really liked aesthetically. And they may have declined because of pesticide use. They may have declined because people no longer were using wooden fence posts and they didn't have old orchard or apple orchards with the hollow hollows that woodpeckers would make in the trees. And
very big effort across the country. Not that it was a national effort, but lots of people pitched in, really has seen a tremendous return of bluebirds. They're now, you know, it's not that we've seen them a lot, but when we're in open country, if there are bluebird houses around, you find bluebirds. So they have really thrived, so to speak, on relatively minor attention from people. The purple martin is another one. Their numbers, though, seem to have declined and really not recovered. But there's been a lot of efforts to manage purple martins. We, for a long time at the station, had a big purple martin colony, but they have declined here because of changes in habitat. They like a very open area near water. And down by the beach and the cabins here, 40, 50 years ago, this was totally open. And now the trees have grown up, and it's just not a habitat that appeals to them. But this is a species that people like to have around. So it was really for aesthetic reasons that people found ways to manage them. Well, the next stage in conservation that progressed after all this emphasis on single species, endangered species management, and management for harvest is a concern about ecosystem or regional management or habitat management on a much larger scale with multiple species. And this scarlet tanager is a symbol of large blocks of forest. And people who were monitoring songbirds began to report declines in a number of species around the country. And they were declines primarily of species that required large chunks of forest. And people who were doing studies and monitoring were able to point out how forests were being increasingly fragmented and just disappearing in areas. And then there was another camp of people who said, well, you know, it's really not that. It's not loss of breeding habitat. Look at the changes that have occurred in the winter. Primarily in Central America, in some cases in South America, and in others just in southern coastal regions of the United States. So this problem of songbird decline, I can't imagine you haven't seen something on TV, you haven't talked about it in classes, or you haven't read about it, but it's, you know, where the titles are Another Silent Spring, or Where Have All the Songbirds Gone, or The Mystery of the Missing Migrants. There are all these kind of catchy titles. And this really spurred on groups, agencies like the Forest Service and Fish and Wildlife Service, a lot of the private non-government organizations such as the Nature Conservancy, World Wildlife Fund, poured millions of dollars into figuring out what was going on with forest songbirds. Why are they declining? Are they really declining? Is it happening in the tropics? Is it happening in the breeding areas? And what is making the decline happen? So some of the species that we're focused on were scarlet tanagers. The ovenbird is one that is known to, well, it appears to prefer large blocks of undisturbed forest, but it's also found in marginal lands as well. The rose-breasted grosbeak, mature deciduous forest, and the woodpeckers all depend on older forests, or most of them depend on older forests for food and for nesting. These are not songbirds, but they've been included in the studies. So they're now, there's been enough time that if you look, the result of all the money that went into the Forest Songbird work is if you pick up any journal that publishes on birds, you will find a huge chunk of the papers are on forest songbird studies. So much money went into it. People dropped their research efforts that they'd been pursuing for years just to go for the money. And we now know a lot about forest songbird issues, but a lot of things are still not resolved. there are no nationwide trends for declines in particular species. There are regional declines, and some species may be declining in one place, increasing another. We do know that habitat fragmentation is an important issue. Birds that nest near forest edges or any kind of habitat edge where predators are going to be using these areas have lowered reproductive success. Birds in intact forests in the center have higher reproductive success. They also are not, those in the center are not exposed to cowbird parasitism as in its greater frequency. So we know that those things are influencing bird populations. It's not real clear about what's happening in the wintering grounds. There's some areas where there's tremendous loss of habitat. In other areas where the habitat has been lost, there are some species that seem to be benefiting. So these programs are all, many of them are still continuing. And as with any piece of research, you open one door and you open 50 more. So the forest songbird work, I think, will continue for quite some time. We're still, you know, getting a huge amount of information. The original money is not there, but a lot of these programs are set up. And this is a place where you could get jobs quite easily in the summer based on your experience with class. I also mentioned that, of course, I talked about my work with fighting plovers. So the effort now in many conservation studies is to take a bigger approach. Look at multiple species, think about the landscape, think about conservation issues from a much larger perspective, and including human interests. Because without getting human interests into the picture, you can never resolve most conservation issues. Okay, I'm just going to finish with those species that are now super abundant, overabundant, and just say a few things about what these problems are and where things may be headed. This doesn't sound like a real exciting direction for thinking about future directions. And in fact, coming up with conservation plans at an ecosystem level and regional level for birds, for multi-species, is extremely challenging, and that's going to occupy people working on conservation issues for a long time. Endangered species still need to be held by the wing, so to speak. We do all that very intensive management with piping plovers, so it's not to say that single species management is out. Game species will demand a lot of attention and time simply because of money. But these are kind of, you know, new problems on the horizon. Species like red-winged blackbird and starling have been around for a long time. Of course, this is an exotic. And they do billions of dollars worth of damage to crops during the winter. We don't really see that here. But they migrate down throughout southeastern U.S. And there are a lot of control programs to try and keep the numbers down. The red-winged blackbird, I've heard it reported as being the most abundant land bird now that the pasture pigeon is gone. In North America, and on top of it, a problem species. The mute swan, we've talked about this before. It's appealing, people like to have it around, but it also is responsible for environmental degradation, destruction of the substrate and vegetation in wetlands that may be challenging moons on their nesting platforms. Here is a species that really isn't super abundant or overabundant, but it's increasing in numbers. It hasn't reached anything like the Canada goose. It may be a concern. Right now, it basically is doing its own thing, and there may be a few local control issues. But I just wanted to point this out. We've got a lot of these that are kind of, you know, on the fringe that people wonder about, you know, whether they're going to be, what their future will be. The brown-headed cowbird has definitely increased. It was a bird of the plains, probably followed the bison. And because it followed bison capturing insects, it could not be tied down to a territory and evolved the behavior pattern of not building a nest. It's an obligate nest parasite, cannot build a nest. lays its eggs in other birds' nests, and then it moves on, and the other birds then raise the cowbird young. It's been very successful. When Michigan was cleared, prior to that, cowbirds were not in Michigan, probably. They moved way up into Michigan with the clearing of the forest and followed in with the farmland. So the distribution of cowbirds has changed. Next week, on the 29th, we're going to have one of the world's experts in cowbirds here giving a talk at the required lecture, the Hahn Lecture. He's also probably going to go out in the field with us and has offered just to meet and talk with you folks. And so I'm going to work with him to come up with an idea of kind of a general lecture about cowbirds, why cowbirds are interesting. So you have that going forward. This is my special species of interest as a overabundant species. You've heard me talk about this, double-crested cormorant. In the state of Michigan, a big worry because they are increasing, and where they're increasing, sports fishing is very, very popular and is a tremendous source of revenue for people. And there's tremendous concern that cormorants are eating the sports fish, perch in particular. The studies do not show that have been done on diet and so on, do not show that the cormorants have a big impact. That's hard to discuss with people when they're fishing and they see cormorants zinging around their boat, catching fish faster than they are. The cormorants have gone from about 700 pairs 20 years ago to over 50,000 in the Great Lakes, and they're increasing everywhere. And this is probably in response to banning of DDT, and also a big thing is a change, a conversion of the cotton crop in southern U.S. to catfish farming. Because now the birds have a great source of food in the winter, so mortality is lowered, juvenile mortality is greatly lowered, now they're breeding when they're one instead of 4 years old, and so on. What will the future be? There's a depredation order. Anyone working with an aquaculture facility can shoot cormorants if they see them catching or about to catch a fish. And local communities are pushing for local cormorant. I really don't know where this is going to go, but Fish and Wildlife Service is under tremendous pressure. One phone rings from a congressman who says, get rid of those damn birds, and the next phone call is from an animal rights group saying, you touch those birds, you'll be in court. So the poor person that has to answer that phone has got jangled nerves. Julie.
Are they an exotic species?
No, these are native to North America. These are protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and so they have to. There is a special, what's called a depredation order, that is signed by the Secretary of the Interior that allows the shooting of birds that are damaging human property. Anyway, that's a story to watch. This is a story, though, that I really want you to watch, because this is going to make big national news on and off. It's already started, but I haven't really seen any big articles yet. This is a snow goose. The snow geese nest up in the Arctic, around Hudson's Bay, James Bay, by the millions. And they're grazers like the other geese. They feed on vegetation. In the winter, they go down to the southern U.S., and they're in many places are on wildlife refuges, but they go into farmers' and agricultural lands, and they feed a lot on new rice, new wheat, all kinds of typically what you think of as kind of short grass crops. They've been protected. There is a hunting season on this species, and the numbers have began to increase slowly, slowly, and now the numbers are so great that this is probably the only vertebrate species whose impact can be seen from satellite, because their impact on the vegetation in the tundra is unbelievable. I've seen the satellite photos, and they have completely destroyed the vegetation that they require to feed on. And it's, you know, it's basically down to the bare soil. So this means that the whole tundra environment is changing. So what do? Well, they shift their nesting patterns in response to this. There is no predator that can even begin to make a dent. Their most feared predator is the Arctic fox. Well, if you've got millions of birds, even hundreds of Arctic foxes are not going to even begin to make a dent. So, and then there's the concern of these birds, where they're going in the winter. Some areas, there doesn't seem to be a big impact where they're spread out, but others, there is. So Fish and Wildlife Service is in huge debates with Ducks Unlimited and all the other agencies and non-government conservation groups to try and make a decision that will lead to a solution to the problem. And one thing that's very difficult, a logical solution would be increase what's called the bag limit. Increase the number of birds that can be taken by a hunter. Well, they already have done that, and people are not harvesting at a higher level. You know, people don't want 20 snow geese or whatever the level is. Another possibility is that they will lengthen the season of harvest, and probably the next step will be a spring harvest. Whether or not these will have the impact that they want in terms of bringing the numbers down is, you know, it's not known, because the numbers are so large that it's just difficult to make predictions as to how the entire population will respond to different harvest levels. But this is very contentious, from groups who don't want the birds touched to people who are concerned about the quality of the Arctic environment. Is this affecting other species? Will this have global implications on all kinds of things, water quality and just the watershed patterns and so on in the Arctic? So it's a fascinating problem. I'm glad I don't have to deal with it. And it's something that I predict this fall you're going to start seeing more in the newspaper, so you can remember that you heard about it here first. Okay, I think that may be my last one. It is. And anybody have specific questions or non-specific questions? Wants to know how reliable the bird atlases are with groups of people going out. How reliable were you folks this morning? You know, with any data set, the longer you do it, the more accurate your patterns are going to be. You recognize that with a group of amateurs that you are, that there are going to be errors. With the group that's doing the breeding bird survey, there are going to be errors. But the overall pattern and just the strength of the numbers in terms of the data, that's what really counts. And I think that the patterns are quite accurate. I know for some species, they're not going to be, because we just don't know enough. They're too secretive. There was one that I looked at, and I was kind of surprised. I can't remember what it was. But the distribution was kind of as thin as it was. But if you would look under, say, least bitterns, there's not going to be much information. That's because people aren't out in the marshes looking for least bitterns. And for the breeding bird survey, that's where people are driving a route. Well, you're not going to have a good record of casting return distribution. They're out on islands, out in Northern Commission. But that information is reported. So, breeding bird survey
info that's then converted to a map is very, it's not at all accurate for some species. But for a lot of species, I think it shows, you know, very good regional patterns. We just have, you know, people just have to keep and will continue to refine the methodology. Yes? How did they get to the, through protection is one thing, and very carefully monitored hunting seasons, because my guess is they were probably over-harvested early in the century. They would have been a very popular species to eat. And then, like the cormorant, the conversion of cotton or other crops into, like, rice was not a big crop historically in the South, but it now is, and they feed very heavily in these rice paddy fields. And so that would be another, that is probably a very important issue. And then the numbers, you know, slowly began to build up and moved outside the framework that any natural predation effect, including human. And so now it really is, has led to, probably as we speak, meetings going on. It's a very contentious thing and a very, very difficult problem to solve for lots of reasons.
But they don't consider using it as an economic trying to harvest it?
I know there have been discussions of opening up harvest for native populations so that they, you know, essentially can harvest and sell, for example. I don't know what's going to happen. The last time I talked to someone who's fairly close to this issue, he works for Ducks Unlimited, he said he thought what was going to happen is that they would have a spring hunt, which is almost unheard of because that's the breeding season. The only other species that I can think of that has a spring hunt is a turkey season. You know what I mean? But to have a waterfowl hunt with snow geese during the spring would be a very major thing. And it's probably something that some people will block. Others will endorse. Some will say this is not going to work. So the whole kind of area of managing is an opportunity for people here. If people are interested in dealing with human social issues and wildlife protection, wildlife biology, people are not trained. They do not know how to deal with these kinds of very sticky problems. And they are very difficult. And, you know, the list goes on and on. We just talked about a few birds. What about, zebra mussels? Okay, I have one little task. You're all ready to race out and jump in the lake and do something. We need to compile the info from the sun this morning, which is not a big job. If you go into your groups, and what you need to do, I don't care about the individual points. What we care about is doing like we typically do in the checklist. I've got two right here. You're going to summarize and put those on the checklist. Just have these.